The opinions expressed on the following sponsored program are strictly those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, management, or sponsors. You are tuned to Natural Doc Radio, brought to you by AMT Centers, bringing you health information based on the latest research from respected sources around the world. Learn what you can do to enhance health, strengthen muscles, maximize memory, and energize all the systems of your body. Every day, listen for health information on the latest testing procedures available at AMT Centers, as well as the interpretation and action needed based on your test results. Listen for special events at Advanced Medical Testing Centers. Tune in. Get healthy. Now, here are your hosts for the hour, Dr. Herb Slavin, MD, and Janet Cimarelli, licensed nutrition counselor.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Natural Doc Radio. I'm Dr. Herb Slavin. And joining me today is Janet Cimarelli, licensed nutritionist. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Dr. Slavin.
And, you know, over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about infectious diseases and how they might be implicated in various illnesses that really aren't known to be associated with infectious diseases. We know that cancer, certain types of cancer are definitely associated with a viral infection. But the literature points to heart disease and high blood pressure having an infectious disease component. And then when and Alzheimer's disease as well. And then when I saw this headline, donated blood won't transmit Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, I thought that was interesting, and it was even more interesting how they came to that conclusion. The way they did the study, they tracked the data on 40,000 patients, and this study was done in Denmark and Sweden. All right, so think about this: they had 40,000 patients, all of whom had received blood transfusions between 1968 and 2012. From people who were later diagnosed with any form of dementia or Parkinson's disease. So right off the bat, I'm wondering, could the cause of their dementia occurred after the transfusion, after they had donated blood? You can't automatically assume that that was present. In any event, they compare those 400,000 people in the incidence of dementia or Parkinson's with 1.4 million patients who did not receive blood transfusions. And I wanted to see if there was any difference in the incidence of those two conditions. And they came to the conclusion that in both groups, the chance of developing any neurodegenerative disorder was the same, so that the blood transfusions from people who had been who were later diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disorder was not the issue there. So the conclusion was, if someone develops Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease and they had received a transfusion at some point, then based on this study, we can reassure them it was not from the transfusion. Now, it's interesting how they're so quick to acknowledge the efficacy of the study, and it's what's even more amazing is that there's only been one study, apparently, because they don't refer to any other studies on this topic. And they go on to say that patients with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease need not be disqualified as potential blood donors. And that study was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine this week. So I said, okay, I'm kind of curious, because we've been talking about all the different infections that have been linked to various conditions that, you know, normally aren't thought about, you know, cytomegalovirus, herpes virus 1 and 2, H. pylori, chlamydia pneumonia, even the influenza virus, mycoplasma pneumonia. So there's a bunch of different bacteria and viruses that have been associated with these conditions. So I went to the website, American Red Cross, to see how they're screening the blood that they take from people. And they don't really screen for a lot of different things. Janet, do you have any idea what they screen for?
I think that they screen for iron levels and red blood cell count. The thing that I'm thinking about is, all right, we are not disqualifying diagnosed Alzheimer's patients or Parkinson's patients, but are we asking those patients what medications they're on? Are we asking in general what medications people are on, what hormones people are taking? So there are so many more details that would be valid points of discussion rather than just Parkinson's patients and Alzheimer's patients.
Well, they do screen for certain infections. They screen for hepatitis. And I think that might have been the first infectious disease they screened for. Because I can remember a time prior to that, before they, you know, understood the transmission with blood transfusions, that people were acquiring hepatitis from blood transfusions.
Right.
Now they screen for it. And they screen for HIV. And they screen, this is an interesting one, they screen for Trypanosoma cruzi. That's the infectious agent responsible for Chagas disease. I haven't seen much of that. And
it's interesting that they find that that is important enough to screen for.
Then they screen for human T lymphotropic virus. They say that's a human retrovirus that's been associated with neoplastic conditions, in other words, cancer, and a variety of demyelinating disorders. A demyelinating disorder would be something like multiple sclerosis. They screen for syphilis. Now, syphilis is the other famous spirochete, but the one in the news lately is Lyme disease. But they don't screen for Lyme disease, interestingly. And you have West Nile virus they're screening for. And this is the American Red Cross guidelines. And then...
Dr. Slavin, how soon is the Zika virus able to be detected in the blood? So let's say you were bitten by a mosquito, and 2 weeks later you went to the blood donation center and donated blood. Number one, I doubt that they're screening for the Zika virus. And number two, how quickly might it show up in your blood?
You know, I don't remember. I remember something where it said that by the time you become symptomatic, let's put it this way, that they're screening for antibodies is what they look for. So It takes a little bit of time to develop antibodies, but in the meantime, you'll come down with Zika. So doing that screening really doesn't help you. So it's like a retrospective look at what you were exposed to. And you may be over the illness because the majority of people... don't have a problem. Now, I don't know if you heard it yet, but it was reported yesterday in Broward that a baby was born with microcephaly in a mother that was positive for Zika, and they think she got the Zika in Jamaica. And I'm wondering, since the beginning, since its identification back in 1946, when they never associated microcephaly with Zika, I wonder if the virus could have mutated a little bit and changed its how it affects people.
Well, they were making statements with regard to spraying insecticide in known areas of the particular type of mosquito that is a Zika virus carrier, and that certain of those mosquitoes were going to mutate and become resistant to the pesticide.
Now, I just want to finish up on what they test for or screen for when they when someone donates blood. They do a blood type, so that, you know, ABO and RH typing they do. They also look for atypical or unusual red blood cell antibodies. It looks like they are looking for the presence of cytomegalovirus. And then they have some investigational protocols where an infectious disease agent might be present in a certain geographic region of the U.S. For example, dengue fever, you know, it's a virus present in Puerto Rico. And they may look for the parasite that causes babesiosis in New England and the upper Midwest. So they do some selective things, but they're not checking for all the potential problems. And despite the fact that they say you don't have to worry about it, I'm not so sure.
Okay, what do you think, Dr. Slavin, of people banking their own blood?
Well, I think that, you know, if, you know, people do that when they are planning a non-emergent operation. You know, maybe they're planning to have hip surgery or some other orthopedic operation, or and, you know, and you can bank your own blood. I think that's a good idea. I don't know how widespread it is. Now I'm just checking to see if they, you mentioned medications and hormones on, and I'm just wondering where they, what they look for there. So the American Red Cross
may be less than optimal what they're looking for there when you think about the number of pharmaceuticals that are being used across the population.
So here's what they say as far as, say, antibiotics. A donor with an acute infection should not donate blood. The reason for the antibiotic use must be evaluated to determine if the donor has a bacterial infection that could be transmissible by blood. Acceptable after finishing oral antibiotics for an infection, may have taken the last pill on the date of donation. If you got an injection of an antibiotic, then they say you can donate 10 days after the injection. If you're taking antibiotics to prevent an infection, for example, following a dental procedure or for acne, then you know, they may allow the blood to be donated.
Dr. Slavin, that music.
Will you hear music? I don't hear.
Signal for our time to take a break.
All right, you're listening to Natural Doc Radio, and we'll be back right after this.
Fragrant, moisturizing. What is it? Janabomb. The best taste from all organic ingredients to smooth your lips. The best fragrance from all organic ingredients to soothe a bite from a mosquito or no-see-um. Heal your chapped lips. Stop the itch from an insect bite. Just a dab of Janabomb on your lips or on a rash and get relief. Janabomb's great for lips, rash, or insect bite. Find out more at Janazon.com.
Are you concerned with the current state of your heart and blood vessels? Advanced Medical Testing Centers, your premier blood draw center, draws for Singulex Labs, which offers specialized blood tests that can help you uncover hidden cardiovascular disease that other tests may miss. Talk to your doctor today about the Singulex test and call Advanced Medical Testing Centers to schedule your blood draw. We guarantee your on-time appointment and guarantee the lowest price. Call us at 754-216-2332. That's 754-216-2332. Or visit us at amtcenters.com. Advanced Medical Testing Centers is a proud sponsor of Natural Doc Radio, which airs on this station each weekday morning at 10 a.m.
Janabiotic is a way to support your immune system, as well as enhance the function of your digestive tract and help to maintain regularity. One or two capsules per day provide the basic chemistry needed for healthy gastrointestinal function. Support your good health with the profile of probiotic ingredients in Janabiotic. Find out about Janabiotic at Janazon.com.
You're listening to Natural Doc Radio. I'm Dr. Herb Slavin with Janet Cimarelli, licensed nutritionist. And I think this is an interesting topic, and that is, what do they screen for in the blood of people that donate blood for transfusion? And this came up because there was a study that was done. It was a retrospective study, just wanting to see if people who had received blood from people who had some neurodegenerative disease, it might have been dementia or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, they wanted to see if there was a higher incidence in the people who received blood from those people, and they came to the conclusion there wasn't. And earlier, Janet has said, what about all the drugs people are taking? Well, apparently they let you take antibiotics. And here's an interesting one, Janet. You had mentioned this. Women on oral contraceptives or using other forms of birth control are eligible to donate.
Wow.
And here's another area that they look at, immunizations and vaccination. They say if you received the influenza vaccine, tetanus, meningitis, you can donate providing you're symptom-free and fever-free. They also say that you can donate if you receive the HPV vaccine like Gardasil. They said you can donate blood after immunizations with German measles or the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, chickenpox, or shingles, but you have to wait 4 weeks. So, because you could be trained, those are live vaccines, so they want to make sure that you're not going to come down with it or transmit the virus. You have to wait 2 weeks after immunizations for rubella, mumps and polio and yellow fever. For hepatitis, you have to wait 21 days after immunization before you can donate blood. For smallpox vaccines, I don't think they're doing that anymore, at least in this country. You have to wait 8 weeks from the date of having a smallpox vaccination before you can donate. And then there are some other interesting categories. Now, they're not using bovine insulin anymore. It's all, made in the laboratory. And but if you have a history of using bovine insulin from cattle from the United Kingdom, you're not eligible to donate. And you know why?
Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease?
Yep, mare cow disease, which is a variant of the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. They're concerned about that. And here's another one that you had alluded to earlier. In almost all cases, medications will not disqualify you as a blood donor. So they say, for example, over-the-counter oral homeopathic medications, herbal remedies, nutritional supplements are all acceptable. There are a handful of drugs that are of special significance in blood donation. And if you're on any of those, there's a waiting period after your last dose. before you can donate. Some of those drugs are Accutane, Proscar, Propecia. They say you have to wait at least a month after your last dose. Now, Avodart, wait 6 months from the last dose. It's kind of interesting how long...
One of the categories that I'm thinking about would be the blood thinners, warfarin, Coumadin, Xarelto, some of those. That could be an issue.
All right. They're on the list. We're going to come to that. But right now they say aspirin, there's no waiting period for donating whole blood. However, you must wait 48 hours after your last aspirin dose before donating. Then there's a Feldene, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. There's no waiting period for that. However, you must wait 48 hours after taking your last dose. Now, you mentioned some of the blood thinners. Well, there's Coumadin, Heparin, Pradaxa, Xarelto, or Lovenox, and other prescription blood thinners. You should not donate since your blood will not clot normally. If your doctor discontinues your treatment with blood thinners, you should wait at least 7 days before donating. So there's the answer there. Plavix, you have to wait 14 days after your last dose before donating. And there are a few other drugs that I'm not that familiar with that they just say you need to wait as well. Now, there are certain general health conditions that they probably ask questions for. If you have allergies, stuffy nose, itchy eyes, dry cough, you can donate. If you have the cold or flu, they say wait till the fever or cough goes away. And then they say, you know, wait at least 8 weeks between donations. And there are weight and height limits, too. You have to weigh at least 110 pounds.
Are there age limits?
No, so far I don't see that. And then with allergies, they say you can donate if you have allergies as long as you're feeling well. Same thing with asthma. However, if you have a bleeding condition, you know, they'll want to check what it is, and they may disqualify you there. But I found this one interesting. They do have a guidelines as far as your blood pressure goes. So on the high end, your blood pressure has to be below 180 over 100 to donate. And on the low end, they want it to be above 80 over 50 to donate. Now, this is an interesting category, and that's cancer. And they say eligibility depends on the type of cancer and treatment history. If you had leukemia or lymphoma, including Hodgkin's disease, and other cancers of the blood, you are not eligible to donate. So is that their way of saying that these cancers are transmissible? Other types of cancer are acceptable if the cancer has been treated successfully and it's been more than 12 months since treatment was completed, and there has been no cancer recurrence in that time. And then you have the lower risk in situ cancers, including squamous and basal cell cancers of the skin, that if they've been completely removed and do not require a 12-month waiting period. So I find that interesting that they won't allow people with a history of blood cancers to donate. Most chronic illnesses are acceptable as long as you feel well. And then, you know, we mentioned earlier about if you've used bovine insulin. Well, if you have any possibility of the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or used human pituitary growth hormone, you won't be allowed to donate. Diabetics who are well controlled on insulin or oral medications are eligible. And as far as heart disease, if in general you're allowed to donate as long as you're stable, In other words, no chest pain and no limitations on your activities. If you have symptoms, then there's a waiting period of at least 6 months. If you have a heart murmur, you can donate as long as you have no symptoms. Here's a topic that people should be aware of, and that's hemochromatosis. And how do you find out if you have it? Because in its earliest stages, it's an asymptomatic illness, and it's picked up by physicians when they see an elevated ferritin level, which suggests that there's increased iron in the body. So, if you have hemochromatosis, you are not eligible to donate. And all things set aside, your hemoglobin has to be above 12 and a half to be allowed to donate. Now, what about hepatitis? You would think automatically they would exempt you from donating. So if you have hepatitis caused by a virus or unexplained jaundice, in other words, yellow discoloration of the skin, since age 11, you're not eligible to donate. So that also includes other causes of hepatitis, like cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus. But you're allowed to donate, even with a history of hepatitis or jaundice, caused by something other than a viral infection. For example, Gilbert's disease, bile duct obstruction, alcoholic gallstones, or trauma to the liver. But if you tested positive, like we mentioned earlier, for hepatitis B or C, you're not eligible. Now, we mentioned, if hepatitis or AIDS, you shouldn't donate.
Okay. Are the donation centers relying on self-reporting, or are they actually screening for these aspects in your blood?
Well, I think a lot of this is going to be self-reporting. You're going to have to be honest. Now, here's another category. We don't see this condition here, malaria. Malaria is another disease transmitted by a mosquito bite, and it can be transmitted through a blood transfusion. The interesting thing here is...
we don't necessarily see it here in the United States, but immigrants from other nations where malaria might be relatively common, that can be an issue with their potential blood donations.
Well, here's what they say. The reason blood donations are not tested for malaria, because there's no test for malaria. So here's what they do. If you've traveled or lived in a malaria risk country, there will be a waiting period before you can donate blood. If you've been treated for malaria, you have to wait at least 3 years. If you've come back after a trip to a malaria country, you have to wait at least 12 months. And then if you've lived in an area for more than 5 years, you have to wait 3 years before being allowed to donate. And I hear some music, which means it's time for another break. You're listening to Natural Doc Radio. I'm Dr. Herb Slavin with Janice Cimarelli, licensed nutritionist. And we'll be back right after this.
Advanced Medical Testing Centers is proud to sponsor Natural Doc Radio, co-hosted by Herbert Slavin and Janet Cimarelli. They're located at 7200 West Commercial Boulevard, Suite 209 in Lauderhill. And you can find them on the web at advancedmedicaltesting.com. Advanced Medical Testing Centers is your premier blood draw center, staffed by professionals with over 15 years' experience. Clean, comfortable, and efficient. They guarantee your appointment time and guarantee the lowest prices. They test for cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and more. They draw for all specialty labs, including Access, Health Diagnostics, Simulex, Innovative, Quest, LabCorp, and others. Call them today to set up an appointment. 754-216-2332. That's 754-216-2332.
Hi, I'm Janet Zimmerilli, and I'm here to tell you about Dr. Herb Slavin, the medical director of the Institute of Advanced Medicine in Lauderhill. The Institute brings the latest natural approaches to health, supported by research. We offer a full range of traditional and holistic treatments. The primary goal of the Institute of Advanced Medicine is to give you, the patient, the information you need to stay healthy and live long. So before you feel sick, before you develop symptoms, come see the team at the Institute of Advanced Medicine. You can call today, 954-748-4991, to learn all about the services offered at the Institute. Services from on-demand to chiropractic, from natural skin solutions to nutrition testing and support. 954-748-4991. You can visit drslavin.com to learn more.
You're listening to Natural Doc Radio. I'm Dr. Herb Slavin with Janice Cimarelli, licensed nutritionist. We've been reviewing the criteria for donating blood and who can and who can't. And there's a couple other interesting things. If you've had any piercing of your body, or even electrolysis, you can donate blood as long as the instruments used were sterile and single-use equipment. If there's any question, they say you should wait 12 months. If you're pregnant, you're not eligible to donate, but you can donate 6 weeks after giving birth. Now, here's an interesting category. If you've had a tattoo, they say you should wait 12 months after a tattoo if the tattoo was applied in a state that does not regulate tattoo facilities. Currently, this is something I never really gave much thought to. Currently, the only states that do not regulate tattoo facilities are the District of Columbia, Georgia, Idaho, Maryland, Massachusetts, Nevada, New Hampshire, New York, Pennsylvania, Utah, and Wyoming. So it's kind of interesting that in those states, I guess the tattoo parlors can do what they want. A tattoo is acceptable if the tattoo was applied by a state-regulated entity using sterile needles and ink that is not reused. Now, whoever thought of that, that they would even consider reusing ink? So,
whoever considered that there are tattoo facilities that are not regulated, so you're piercing the skin, introducing an outside substance into the body. Very, very interesting that is not regulated.
Now, if you've had a sexually transmitted disease, it seems that they want at least a 12-month waiting period. And they're talking about chlamydia, human papillomavirus, genital herpes. But they say, those are not, you can donate even if you have those conditions, as long as you're feeling well. I'm not so sure how comfortable I would be knowing that there's such laxity in who's allowed to give blood. Now, here's the latest regarding Zika virus exposure. The American Red Cross says, we ask you not to donate if you've had any Zika virus risk exposure. So they're not really screening or testing you. They're just saying if you were at risk. They say, we are asking you to return to donate blood 4 weeks after your last risk exposure. You know, it's interesting. They didn't say they're screening for Zika. They just said you have to self-report. So this all came up because of a report that said you don't have to worry about the transmissibility of dementia like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease from a blood transfusion. And, there's a couple of things absent from this list. They didn't mention Lyme disease, which we know has been associated with dementia, you know, Neuro-Lyme. So I, you know, we've been talking about the prevalence of infections causing problems that are being overlooked by the medical establishment because they just, you know, never consider that. They're focused on treating the symptoms that the infection causes rather than treating the infection. And some of those symptoms are atherosclerosis, hypertension. In certain cases, it could be Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. So I think it wouldn't be unreasonable to ask your physician to, you know, run a panel of infectious diseases. Because if you have an infectious disease that comes up positive, in other words, antibodies to it, along with an elevated C-reactive protein, that may be a sign that it's actually active and you might want to consider doing something about it. You know, in addition to the drugs you're taking for the symptoms of the illness.
What about the idea, Dr. Slavin, that after someone has received a transfusion or multiple transfusions, to come in for a UV LRX or an ultraviolet blood treatment, because at least you have a very reasonable expectation that those treatments without side effects would be able to overcome whatever infectious agent you may have been exposed to.
No, I think that's an option. I think as people learn more about the benefits of what we'll call polychromatic intravenous light therapy, they might consider that. But at the very least, if you've had a blood transfusion, do a blood test, but not right away. It may take a couple of weeks to develop antibodies. Do a blood test to see if any infections turn up, even though you may not be symptomatic. In the usual sense, you know, traditionally, you know, we screen for hepatitis and we know what happens. You know, the hepatitis causes inflammation of the liver, or you screen for AIDS and you can do a test and that causes its series of problems. But there are a lot of conditions that occur and the medical community is not putting two and two together. In other words, they're not thinking that maybe an infectious disease might be causing it. So I think at the very least, you know, check for the presence of infectious diseases. That may be the key to getting better rather than just taking drugs to treat symptoms. Jan, I want to just switch topics a little bit. Because this is kind of interesting. We talk about how to keep people healthy. And here is a list of the 9 most popular food, drink, or medicines that can cause chronic disease. And the way they cause chronic disease, they affect the bacteria in your digestive tract. So I thought this was kind of interesting. Number 1 on the list are vaccines and flu shots. They can upset your digestive system. Vaccines often contain blood from monkeys, cows, and humans. And all of this causes severe gastrointestinal problems and may even affect your own immunity, your immune status. Here's one to really consider, soda. Nothing destroys more good flora than the phosphoric acid in soda. So that's normally we think about soda affecting your teeth, but here they're saying it can affect your beneficial bacteria in your digestive tract. Another area to be concerned about, causing illness because it upsets your digestive tract, are genetically modified organisms found in foods. In other words, you want GMO-free. If you don't see that label, then you have to assume that food is genetically modified and loaded with pesticides. And clearly, you know, the pesticide is going to kill the healthy bacteria. And one of the pesticides they use is glyphosate. And glyphosate is the most lethal cancer-causing herbicide on planet Earth. It's the active ingredient in Roundup, and it's sprayed heavily on conventional grains right before they're put in the silos. And they use that because they say it's a drying agent. Now, Janet, I have a question about that. Well, if they spray that on a grain after the harvest, could they still call that grain organic?
Unfortunately, many interpretations of organic could very well include grains that have been sprayed after harvesting during storage. And they're not calling it a pesticide. They're not calling it an herbicide. They're calling it a drying agent. And when they categorize it as a drying agent, it sounds very benign. Another area that is questionable is the whole thing of organic canola oil. All of the canola comes from a genetically modified rapeseed. And even though it's grown in an organic fashion without pesticides, herbicides, and artificial fertilizers, I say that it is a genetically modified organism or the product of a genetically modified organism. And these oils, the canola oil, is sold as organic. So it's another aspect of splitting hairs. And you truly want to go for as pure and organic without being assaulted with a variety of different chemicals, no matter how you categorize them. That's something that you want to be purchasing from manufacturers and companies and producers that truly adhere to the spirit of organic category. And the OCA.org, Organic Consumers Association, that's one of the best places to familiarize yourself with companies that are providing truly organic substances, foods.
All right, and John, here's another category, bleached foods. I don't think they even say that on the label. Here's what you have to remember. Most foods are not naturally white. So what comes under the category of bleached foods? You have white pasta, white bread, white sugar, white flour, white rice. So think about that. There's a couple more on this list, but we'll get to that after we come back from the break. You're listening to Natural Doc Radio. I'm Dr. Herb Slavin with Janet Cimarelli, licensed nutritionist, and we'll be back right after this.
Did you know that you can be eating a healthy diet, but that your body may not be absorbing the vitamins and nutrients from your foods? Advanced Medical Testing Centers is a premier blood draw center servicing Genova Diagnostics Lab. Genova offers an advanced comprehensive blood test that identifies your body's deficiencies in absorbing vitamins, nutrients, and essential cofactors. Advanced Medical Testing Centers is located at 7200 West Commercial Boulevard in Lauderhill. They offer an on-time appointment guarantee and the lowest price guarantee. Schedule your appointment today for a blood draw for the Genova Diagnostics Nutritional Evaluation Test. Call Advanced Medical Testing Centers at 754-216-2332. That's 754-216-2332. Or visit us at amtcenters.com.
Janet Cimarelli is the licensed nutrition counselor and co-host of Natural Doc Radio. Are you in search of the fountain of youth, trying to figure out how to stay young and healthy? There are three main factors that will determine how well you age. The good news is you can take control of all of them and dramatically slow down your aging process. Through her remote counseling sessions, she works with many clients to help them manage these three areas to stay young, vibrant, and healthy. She can help you maintain optimal health that will have you looking and feeling young again. She offers sessions through telephone, Skype, or email. Sessions are 30 minutes long, and she provides you with the in-depth knowledge and information you need to slow the aging process. Schedule your appointment today at JanetCimarelli.com. Don't wait. Your clock is ticking.
You're listening to Natural Doc Radio. I'm Dr. Herb Slavin with Janet Cimarelli, licensed nutritionist. We've been going through a list of popular foods and drinks and medications that destroy the good bacteria in your digestive tract. And I think a lot of the things on the list you probably don't even think about. But after hearing it, I think you will. On the list is also Splenda or sucralose. It may inflame the liver. It could shrink the thymus. And should be avoided. I think my recommendation is avoid all artificial sweeteners. If you have to sweeten something, stevia is a good choice, or just organic cane sugar. Janet, when they talk about stevia, do they say organic stevia? Is that available?
That's an interesting question. I believe that there are stevias that are categorized both as organic and not necessarily labeled organic.
Now, here's a topic I'd like you to comment on, Janet. They say that the cheap supplements are usually loaded with heavy metal toxins. And they give examples like One-A-Day, Centrum, or Equate. You might want to think twice about using those types of supplements.
I talk to people all the time about commercially available supplements. And what I tell people to do is check other ingredients. So you look outside of the supplement facts label, and there's very small print that says other ingredients. And it's not unusual to see polysorbate 80, polyethylene glycol, talc, artificial colors, caramel color, so many different contaminating substances. And that doesn't even begin to address the quality of the nutrients that are listed in the supplement facts category on the label. Very often, the quality of those bulk ingredients may very well be contaminated or adulterated. Contaminated in such a way with fibers, wood pulp, that kind of thing, to have a greater volume of the particular raw material being delivered to the manufacturer. And so fewer of the nutrient ingredients are present in each supplement. Then you think about, okay, here's magnesium as an example. So many people need magnesium. And the magnesium, if it's in the form of magnesium oxide, very poorly utilized and taken up on a cellular level. So you may be taking magnesium every evening, but it isn't doing anything to relax the muscles, enhance cellular function. It's merely going right through the body. So you truly need to be looking for chelated versions of minerals. Those are more expensive and typically not found in commercial vitamins. The last thing that I tell people, it gives you a one point of identification that will provide a view of the whole quality of the supplement that you're taking. And I say, look at the vitamin E. If it says DL, it is synthetic E, and it is absorbed at about one-tenth of the label dose. So if they're saying that you're getting 50 IUs of vitamin E, if the source of that vitamin E is DL alpha tocopherol, then you're absorbing, the potential to absorb is maybe 5 IUs. I use. So 1/10 of the labeled dose is typically what you would absorb when it is a synthetic vitamin E. And if the company uses a synthetic vitamin E, if they use artificial colors, if they use preservatives and fillers, then you have a very good insight into the fact that that is not a quality supplement that's going to be supportive of overall good health and absorption of nutrients.
And the synthetic vitamins will also block the absorption of the healthier vitamins, the natural vitamins. So beware of all synthetic vitamins. Avoid fluoridated tap water. And I'll add in chlorinated tap water as well.
It's very difficult, Dr. Slavin, to get rid of fluoride. And it's interesting because I think the town of Wellington just recently voted on whether to put fluoride in the municipal water. And I don't know the results of that vote, but hopefully they were wise enough to refuse the use of a poor quality source of fluoride that truly does not create a situation where you're reducing the potential for developing cavities. And it is a form of mass medication. Everybody in the town would then be ingesting fluoride because it's, as I said, it's very difficult to get the fluoride out of the water once it has been put in there. The other part of it is older citizens, people over the age of 55, if they're ingesting fluoride, the risk of hip fracture has been studied and identified as an outcome in older citizens because of exposure to fluoride.
Well, it was interesting, Janet. You mentioned that in Wellington. Back in 2014, they opted not to put fluoride in, and then it came up again. And, you know, I was just Googling that, the results of that haven't come up, but
isn't it interesting that the citizens have made a decision? No, indeed, they don't want. Pardon me, they don't want fluoride in the water, and it's coming up again. We have to have this discussion over and over and over again, and having this discussion when we know what the negatives are that are associated with this mass medication of people through the water supply.
So let's see what it says here. The debate over fluoride use surfaces again in Wellington. It's back in the spotlight for the first time since 2014 when they opted to stop fluoridating the water. And they were adding the fluoride since 2000. 2014, they stopped adding it. So they went back to revisit it to see if the people, I guess, want to put the fluoride back in. I don't think they say the answer here is what they decided to do. Oh, here's why, Janet. The debate in Wellington has already began, but if you have a strong opinion either way, the day to voice it is June 28th at 7 p.m. The council will be listening to both sides before making a decision. Now, interesting, it's not a vote. The council is going to just listen and then decide on their own how they want to do this. Oh, okay. I just got all right, so the person from the radio station just said he lives in Wellington and he decided to put it back in. I guess who's going to be held accountable for that, you know? Because fluoride has been associated with cancer, weakening bones, a lot of health issues associated with fluoride. And they don't care. So, Janet, you heard that, right? Fluoride is back.
I did hear that, and I have to say it isn't easy to get the fluoride out of the water once it's been put in. And the other part of it is, how much is that costing the city of Wellington? And Do the council members in the city of Wellington understand that the fluoride that is being offered to them at a price is actually categorized as an industrial waste, and the source of that industrial waste would have to pay dearly to dispose of it in a hazardous waste dump?
You know, I wanted to see where the fluoride comes from that they put in the water. Not that easy to find the answer to that question. We just know that fluoride is a bad thing to add to water. I just thought it'd be interesting. Well, you know, they have to go out of their way to put more fluoride in. And it, we know it's an industrial waste product. So where are they, you know, where are they getting it from? So there's a another reason to filter the water in your house. If you choose to drink tap water, you want to get a either distill it or reverse osmosis. We'll take that out, but other forms of filtration probably won't take the fluoride out. So you should be aware of that. And I think that that almost does it for today. We've got another minute or so. And just as a summary, just that infectious diseases are more prevalent and perhaps more serious than we think, that you could be suffering from an infectious disease even though you feel good, and it could be creating harm in your body at a subclinical level. In other words, it could be related to high blood pressure, could be related to the development of atherosclerosis, or even Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease. Nobody is looking at it, those conditions. They just treat the symptoms. Just think about the medications they use. They give you statin drugs, and they'll give you symptomatic treatments for chest pain from poor circulation. So just something to think about. Ask your doctors to run those panels. And I think I hear music, which means we've just run out of time. I'd like to thank all of our listeners. You've been listening to Natural Doc Radio. Dr. Herb Slavin with Janice Cimarelli, licensed nutritionist, and we'll be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. Bye-bye, everybody.
You have been listening to Natural Doc Radio, brought to you by AMT Centers, bringing you health information based on the latest research from respected sources around the world. Learn what you can do to enhance health, strengthen muscles, maximize memory, and energize all the systems of your body. Listen every day for health information on the latest testing procedures available at AMT Centers, as well as the interpretation and action needed based on your test results. Listen for special events at Advanced Medical Testing Centers. Tune in again next time and get healthy. The opinions expressed on the preceding sponsored program were strictly those of its hosts, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, management, or sponsors.